From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Dan Richards. Over the last few years, you've probably seen the headlines or heard the news.
Starbucks workers in upstate New York.
Workers at an Apple store in Atlanta.
Voting is underway as Amazon workers decide whether to form a union.
The nation now has nearly 100,000 workers protesting what they consider to be unfair wages.
It also goes to show the rising power of labor and workers in the American workforce.
They're part of a growing trend.
And the hype isn't without merit. There were more successful union elections this year than in any year since the early 2000s. And according to a recent Gallup survey, public approval for organized labor is the highest it's been in over 50 years. Despite all this, the percentage of Americans belonging to unions is still small compared to what it once was. So, is this the beginning of a new golden age of unions in America? Or an anomalous few years brought about by a global pandemic and historically low unemployment? To help make sense of all this, I talked with Andrew Schrenk, a professor of sociology and international and public affairs at Watson, and an expert on organized labor's evolution over the 20th century. Andrew thinks working people deserve more of a say over their working conditions, though that might not mean a return to 1950s-style organized labor. That's because 20th-century institutions might not solve the problems that workers face today. And according to Andrew, it's more than just workers' wages on the line. Our entire country's prosperity and stability might depend on giving workers a greater voice in the future of our economy.
One way or the other, something's got to give. You just can't sustain these levels of inequality without seeing some sort of upsurge.
On this episode, a look with Andrew Schrenk into the past, present, and future of organized labor in America. I started by asking Andrew, what exactly accounts for this growth in high-profile unionization efforts of the last few years? Here's what he had to say.
I think to get an upsurge like this, you need at least three things. You need a motive, what sometimes we talk about as a grievance on the part of workers. You need an opportunity for them to mobilize and take advantage of the moment to bring their power to bear. And they need resources, right, with which they can do these things. And if you think about these three things, a grievance or a motive, an opportunity structure, and resources, I do think that all three are present at the moment. I think the motive is pretty straightforward. Real wages for most U.S. workers have more or less flatlined since the 1970s, particularly at the low end of the labor market, the non-college educated workers, what traditionally we've called low-skilled workers. They have terrible working conditions in many cases in terms of their hours, in terms of safety and health, in terms of basic dignity and the way that they're treated by their employers. And then in the past year, real wages, inflation-adjusted wages, have actually declined, not just flatlined. So we're talking about tens of millions of workers who can't expect to live as well as their parents, even when their parents didn't live that well. And they're looking at, Jeff Bezos or Howard Schultz living in virtual castles, flying around in private planes, in Bezos's case, in rocket ships.
Right.
So I think the grievance is pretty clear. But if a grievance was enough to create this kind of upsurge, you'd see upsurges like this all the time. You would have seen them over many, many years. We didn't. And that's where I think the opportunity comes in. What allows workers to mobilize that grievance and do something about it? And here, too, you can look at a rapid decline in the unemployment rate that leaves workers less worried about standing up to their bosses, less worried about retaliation and maybe losing a job. And so, you're not willing to take it anymore in the way you might have been willing to take it back when you had a looser labor market and less opportunity to get a job if things went sideways. As I said, you also need resources. We've seen some of that coming in from the traditional labor movement. Starbucks Workers United, with the union organizing at Starbucks, has actually received a lot of money from the traditional labor movement. You also need human resources.
Something which, according to Andrew, might also be present in these newer movements.
Increasingly, if you've got educated, say in some cases college-educated workers, well-educated workers in low-paid, poorly treated jobs, they're going to have the skill and the self-confidence to stand up to their employers in a way that maybe less educated workers at various points in time haven't had.
And this is actually not as new a phenomenon as it might sound.
I'll give you an example from the 1930s. One of the best studies of the labor leaders of the 1930s is a classic account by a sociologist named C. Wright Mills called New Men of Power. One of the things Mills demonstrates is that the leaders of the New Deal labor movement had dramatically higher levels of education than their fellow workers, than their fellow Americans on average. You know, I don't know this, but I suspect if you were to go to Starbucks, if you were to go to some of these establishments that are seeing organizing campaigns, you would find out that many of the leaders of these organizing campaigns were, as I said, well-educated workers in poorly paid jobs, maybe saddled with college debt, and with the self-confidence and the skill to do something about it.
So we've got these three things present in these current high-profile union drives: motivation or grievance, opportunity, and resources. Do you imagine that more workers or groups of workers might find themselves with these three circumstances in the future? In other words, do you think this is the beginning of a broader movement for organized labor in the U.S.?
Well, I feel like a lot of the media attention to this has been a little bit premature, a little bit exaggerated. I mean, the Starbucks campaigns at this point involve, as far as I can tell, about 3% of the Starbucks labor force. So that's not an enormous percentage. And, you know, we're talking about Starbucks and Amazon, Apple, a few companies, but we're not talking about the 1930s yet. Could it become something like that? I think it could become something like that, but I don't think we're there yet.
It's interesting you bring up the 1930s, because I think when many Americans think of unions, they think of that sort of earlier era. And this actually gets to one of the big questions I wanted to explore with you, which is, if the labor movement in America were truly to have a resurgence, how might it look like those earlier movements? And also, how might it look different? What lessons from the past can workers really learn from today?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Dan. And I think we can exaggerate the similarities. And I worry a little bit that insofar as we do exaggerate those similarities, we'll draw the wrong lessons.
In order to not do that, let's take a little step back and go through some of this early history of labor organizing.
In the 1930s, when you saw an upsurge in organizing, in particular by industrial unions, they brought their power to bear in Washington to effectuate labor law reform. And with the Roosevelt administration in the New Deal era, the unions were able to bring their pressure to bear to encourage the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, the NLRA, also known as the Wagner Act. And that was the law that regulated and oversaw collective bargaining. It still does in the United States.
This all kicked off a sort of feedback loop that benefited organized labor.
When workers gain power on the shop floor could be a classroom if you're a teacher, you know, it could be a construction site, it can be anything. But when you gain power on the shop floor, you at least potentially gain power in Washington as well. You can organize workers at the point of production, but they can also be turned out to vote. Or they can, you know, their dues can be used in some cases to support mobilizing campaigns or political campaigns, and so on and so forth.
They could then push for new laws that would strengthen unions or make it even easier to create them.
And then if that law actually is enforced, they should be able to organize a higher and higher percentage of the labor force that would then increase their power further, which is why, or at least part of the reason why, by the end of the Second World War, you had close to a third of the non-farm labor force in unions. By the early 1950s, it is about a third of the non-farm labor force. And that, you know, is a powerful force not only in organizing contracts in factories, in workplaces, but also in bringing pressure to bear on politicians in Washington.
And so I guess what happened? We had a
So how do you go from a third of the non-farm labor force organized to less than 10%?
Exactly.
You know, a lot of the answers to this, the ones that you commonly hear invoked, have to do with automation and globalization and deindustrialization. And all of that is true. I mean, you know, to give an example, I grew up in upstate New York, and near where I grew up, General Electric had a lot of plants, in particular in Schenectady, New York. At the end of the war, they employed about 45,000 workers. Even when I was a kid in the early 1980s, they employed close to 25,000 workers in that plant. General Electric in Schenectady now employs less than 1,000 unionized workers. Partly they replaced these blue-collar workers with machines, automation. Partly they sent the highly paid, high-skilled, unionized jobs offshore, looking for cheaper labor. And that's where globalization kicks in. Partly, globalization kicks in through trade and the fact that, you know, the U.S. is no longer the only industrial power in the world. Increasingly, you can buy manufactured goods from Japan, from Germany, from China, from, you know, lots of other countries. And so all of these forces converge to undercut the heart of the New Deal labor movement in factories, in mass production industries. But I think part of the story that we often forget is that even before that deindustrialization had really set in, there had been a business pushback against New Deal labor law.
One of the first moves in this pushback was the Taft-Hartley Act, which was passed in 1947, just after World War II, and amended the National Labor Relations Act. The Taft-Hartley amendments started reining in the power of organized labor well before things like globalization and automation had really started to change the American economy.
The Taft-Hartley amendments outlaw a lot of the strategies and tactics that the New Deal labor movement had used to grow and consolidate its power in the first place. Probably most importantly, it banned what's called the closed shop, the idea that you could negotiate a contract that says you can only work in this establishment if you are a member of the union. That was a very powerful tool that labor could use prior to the passage of the Taft-Hartley amendments in 1947.
This all, you could say, started a feedback loop in the other direction, against organized labor, one that favored employers.
When the Taft-Hartley amendments pass, an entire industry of union busting grows up, employer-side law firms and consulting firms that help management take advantage of Taft-Hartley and various other legislation to try to undermine organizing campaigns. And organized labor has been on the defensive ever since. And you start seeing the decline of union density.
A decline that has persisted basically until the present. But to stop that decline, workers can't simply undo the laws and institutions that weaken them and rebuild the unions of yesteryear. According to Andrew, while there is much to learn from the past, the solutions of that era can't alone solve the problems of this one. Here's what he means. Think about the system of organized labor that sprung out of the New Deal.
That system was a great system for that economy, a mass production economy in which a large share of the labor force was employed in very large establishments, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 40,000 workers. But in an economy in which establishment size has shrunk and those sorts of large-scale mass production industries really are no more, it just isn't going to work.
Why not? In many ways, it really comes down to what makes a lot of our modern economy work, the ability to scale. An example.
In order to get a collective bargaining agreement,
in other words, start a formal union.
First, you need to get 30% of the workers in an establishment to sign a card saying that they would like to have an election in which they will vote on whether they will unionize or not. That involves not just organization, in many cases involves lawyers determining who's eligible to sign a card in the first place. If 30% sign cards, the National Labor Relations Board, which is the enforcement body under the National Labor Relations Act, will conduct an election. We have the same process in the election. You have to bring in organizers or organize from the ground up, which is time consuming and costly. And the union will win if it gets 50 plus 1% of the votes.
But that's not the end of the process. Oh no.
then it's time to negotiate a contract. There you need lawyers. There you need organizers. And then if you win the contract, you have to enforce the contract. These contracts don't enforce themselves. So when workers feel their rights are being violated under the contract, they have to file a grievance. There might be arbitration involved. All of this requires a lot of money, a lot of human capital, a lot of human effort, right? Now, think about it. If you're putting those resources into these campaigns, and the payoff is you've got 40,000 workers at a GE plant organized, the payoff is worth it. It's worth putting the time in. It's worth putting the energy in. Now think about trying to organize 9,000 different Starbucks outlets, where each one, by my back of the envelope calculation, has about 35 employees. The workers and their unions or their activists are not going to have the time, the energy, the money to do all of this. Even if they did, the National Labor Relations Board, which oversees these campaigns, these elections, these contracts, is already incredibly backlogged. It doesn't have the staff. It doesn't have the personnel to deal with its current cases. How are they going to take on all of these cases at Starbucks, at Chipotle, at, you know, Amazon, at the Apple Store, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? It's just, it's not really a viable system in the current, more decentralized economy.
Here's a maybe a dumb question, although, you know, I know there are no dumb questions.
There are no
true
dumb questions.
Why can't all these Starbucks branches that want to form unions work as one big union with multiple, you know, locations?
It's conceivable, and there are legal battles about whether this is possible or not. You know, Starbucks does not want this, because if it's allowed and if the National Labor Relations Board and or the courts rule that they're all part of the same bargaining unit, Starbucks is going to fight this tooth and claw, and they're going to have a lot of resources to fight it, and the workers are not going to have a lot of resources to push back.
So in that case, you know, we've looked at these ways now that labor today simply just the nature of the work involved, the organization of industry, it just doesn't map on to the way that organized labor was developed, you know, a century ago or in the 30s or 40s. Are there alternatives for giving workers more voice, whether it's about their wages or their working conditions?
I do think that there are things workers can do. I think these campaigns that are underway now at places like Starbucks, Apple, Amazon, are extraordinarily valuable. Even if they don't lead to the sorts of unions you had in the 30s, even if they don't lead to the sorts of unions that the organizers on the ground are anticipating right now, the mere existence of disruption, the mere existence of workers exercising their voice and pursuing justice at the workplace is not only valuable in its own right, it's simply a moral concern for those of us who do agree with, you know, the UN Declaration of Human Rights that worker voice is a fundamental right. But it also puts employers on notice, puts legislators on notice that if they don't do something, the situation could spin out of hand, that discontented workers are a threat. They're a threat to profits. They're a threat to productivity. And that's where you get reform. And so while I'm not at all convinced that the upsurge we're seeing today is going to lead to something like the 30s or a revitalization of those industrial relations and labor market institutions, and I'm not at all convinced that that will lead to outcomes that are predictable by their own leaders, I think that they, if they continue, will lead to some sort of change that could prove beneficial for workers.
Are there any signs you see that can point to maybe what types of reforms could come? Or are there any examples of institutions, organizations, movements that are not like traditional labor unions that are still providing workers a new type of meaningful voice?
It's a great question, Dan. So let me give you a couple of examples, one outside the confines of the mainstream labor movement, and one that's innovative but within the confines of the existing labor movement. I have worked over the years with an immigrant rights group in New Mexico called Somos Un Pueblo Unido. And this is a community-based organization. that helps immigrants and workers pursue their rights in an array of different places, the workplace, but also the schools, the broader community, etc. But a lot of their cases are workplace related. And what they found was that workers would come to them with concerns about their employment situation, how they were treated on the job. In many cases, they suffered wage theft where the employer was underpaying them, or situations of harassment and things like that, safety concerns. And they found that when they took those complaints to the obvious institutions, you know, the State Department of Labor for wage and hour concerns, or the EEOC for discrimination concerns, or things like that, even if things went well and they won, so to speak, they would be winning a victory for an individual worker. And the payoff wasn't very high. It gets back to my example of, you know, the difference between organizing 20,000 workers in an auto plant versus organizing 35 workers in a Starbucks. Now we're talking one worker, right? But what they realized was that in many cases, most cases, the worker who was being harassed on the job or underpaid was only one of many. You know, that there were other workers they were working with who were suffering the same abuses but weren't coming to SOMOS looking for support. And it turns out that Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act includes language that protects all workers who are engaged in, quote, concerted activity, whether they're a member of a union or not. Most people don't know about this. They don't think about this. And so SOMOS figured this out. And when workers come to them now, they will say, are there others at the hotel you work at, the restaurant you work at, you know, the establishment you work at, going through similar types of abuse? The workers almost invariably say yes. It's rarely an individual thing. They say, bring a group to us. Bring as many as you can to us, because now we can take the case not just to the State Labor Board, not just to OSHA or the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. We can bring it to the National Labor Relations Board. And while the National Labor Relations Board, as I said, is backlogged, it is much more sympathetic to workers than most other agencies. And if you win there, you're not just winning the case for one worker, you're winning the case for a number of workers. So the payoff is much higher. I have worked with a colleague, Jessica Garrick, at the University of Denver. And she has shown in her research that SOMOS is not the only organization using this strategy. A lot of organizations around the country, immigrant rights groups, worker centers, community-based organizations that are out to defend labor, have used similar strategies to bring cases that are not traditionally thought of as collective bargaining cases, National Labor Relations Board type cases, to the NLRB, knowing that it's a more sympathetic audience and the payoff is higher.
Even within traditional labor unions, there are innovations that address how to organize labor in our less concentrated post-industrial economy.
I'll give another example. A couple of friends and colleagues who work with 32BJ, a mass local of the Service Employees Union in New York and surrounding area, Rob Hill and Stuart Eimer, have studied and written about a strategy that 32BJ has used, where when they organize workers, their workforce tends to consist of things like custodial workers, food service workers, airport workers, etc. They will, in the organizing campaign, commit with employers that they will not negotiate a contract until the majority of workers in that labor market have also agreed to unionize. What Stuart Eimer and Rob Hill call the trigger mechanism. And the trigger mechanism essentially says to these employers that if you agree to recognize the union will not actually make demands on you, costly demands on you, until at least half of the workers in your labor market have also signed on to campaigns like this, and wages are effectively taken out of competition.
And what's the benefit of this trigger mechanism?
Well, think about this. The concerns of employers are real. You know, if I own a pizza parlor and my workers unionize, and you own a pizza parlor down the block and your workers don't unionize, all other things being equal, my costs are going to go up, your costs are going to stay the same, and you're going to be able to outcompete me, you know, potentially drive me out of business. I mean, for some employers, this is an existential threat, right? These are not imaginary concerns. But if my workers were signing an agreement that says they will unionize, but they won't pursue wage increases unless and until your workers unionize and push for wage increases, I would be a lot less hostile to their campaign, because I would know that, you know, if and when my workers organized and wages went up, your workers would organize and wages would go up too. I might still be anti-union, but I might not be as dug in, as entrenched in my opposition to unions. And that's a kind of micro-level example of what 32BJ has been doing in the Middle Atlantic states.
Anti-union, but not that anti-union, doesn't sound like a huge victory for organized labor, but it makes a difference.
32BJ in New York has seen its membership rise by tens of thousands of workers in the period in which they've been using the trigger mechanism as a strategy, as unions elsewhere are being decimated. And what Eimer and Hill argue, and I think they're right, is that if other unions were to adopt a strategy like this, they too could see growth, could see empowerment, despite all of the disadvantages workers and unions are at in the current U.S. labor market.
Something else you've written about that I thought was just a very interesting and elegant idea for some of these problems was what you call 911 for workers, or 911 for W. I was wondering if you could just describe that a little and how it speaks to what's not working in labor protections right now.
So let me begin with the diagnosis and then sort of tell you why I think something like 911-4W would be a partial solution. And the diagnosis gets back to what I talked about with sort of the New Deal labor law. New Deal labor law was highly specialized. And by specialized, what I mean is that each different type of abuse was assigned to a different law and a different agency. So the National Labor Relations Act governed collective bargaining. The Fair Labor Standards Act, also from the 1930s, governed wages and hours and was overseen by its own agency, the Wages and Hours Division of the Department of Labor. When safety and health legislation was passed later on, it was assigned to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and so on and so forth. This highly specialized regulatory system, made a certain amount of sense in the post-war period, where you had large factories, again, which could, you know, yield huge payoffs by a visit from OSHA. If OSHA came through, you know, they weren't just governing the safety of 10 workers, they were governing the safety of 10,000 workers. If an organizing campaign happened, the National Labor Relations Board was covering 10,000 workers, not 10 workers. But these days, in the current post-industrial economy with smaller establishments, you know, costs a ton of money to the government and the taxpayer, confuses workers, and just doesn't work. So what do I mean by 911-4W? Well, when you worry that the law has been broken, you know, at home, you've been robbed, you know, or broken into, or, you know, God forbid, assaulted or something like that, you call 911. We all know that, right? There's a single, you know, one-stop shop when you need the police. Workers don't have anything like that. You know, if it's safety and health, they go to one place. If it's wages and hours, they go to, you know, there's a bulletin board in most workplaces with posters from all these agencies, and it just confuses workers, right? You know, and it's also a problem because the same employers who violate one of these laws tend to violate all of these laws. What are you going to do? You're working for some, you know, abusive meatpacking plant in Iowa, and you're going to call five different agencies because your rights have been violated in five different ways?
Right, like one thing's not safe. I'm also working too many hours.
It would take your whole life to pursue all of these complaints, right? I mean, you just can't do it. But imagine if there was a hotline. You know, I call it 911-4-worker, you know, 911-4-W, because it seems like that would be a reasonably okay number to use, and it would be memorable. But, you know, it could be anything, but some sort of, you know, one-stop shop where you could call, and there would be a dispatcher, and you could say, look, I was harassed on the job, and I also haven't been paid overtime. And then there'd be some sort of algorithm, you know, through a database in which the government agencies would figure out, okay, this many complaints have come in about this employment site within the past X months or X years around these issues. You know, you, the worker, would have a much more efficient system of dealing with your concerns, but the government would have centralized information that they don't currently have that would allow them to pinpoint the worst violators, the repeated violators, and do something about them, because a vastly disproportionate share of the violations come from a relatively small number of employers.
Whether we're talking about newer innovations in terms of helping organize labor or a resurgence of more sort of classical unions, Do you think any of the calculations change now that we're in this period that seems a little different economically than it was, you know, maybe a year or two ago when we first started seeing things about organizing at places like Amazon and Starbucks? Now we're in a moment where there's higher inflation. Some experts are concerned we could see some greater economic slowdown coming soon. Is there any reason to think that the conditions have changed in a way that might put labor organizing further on the back foot? In other words, I guess, have we already hit some small peak of labor organizing and now the conditions are no longer ripe for organizing again?
Well, I think it's a great question. I don't want to make predictions. I mean, if I could read the future, I'd be making a lot more money in the stock market than I currently am. But I am concerned about inflation, but I am much more concerned about inflation from a political perspective than from an economic perspective. Now, I might get back to the fact that I'm not an economist. I study politics. But I think it's hard to blame rising wages and workplace empowerment for the current round of inflation, mostly because real wages haven't increased. In fact, in the past year, real wages have declined for most workers. And so it's hard to really talk about a wage price spiral when real wages aren't increasing. It's also hard to blame, say, the stimulus, which we've heard people blaming for inflation, when inflation is a global problem. You know, if I wanted to think about inflation and where this is coming from, I wouldn't just look at the labor market. I would look at things like profits and, you know, the rise of monopoly and oligopoly in a period of massive deregulation of antitrust, and think about whether some of this is being driven by profiteering by large oligopolistic corporations. I would wonder how much of this is about supply chains that have been stretched incredibly thin, in part by efforts to avoid worker power and avoid unionization by shipping the jobs offshore, and in many cases very, very far away, such that the supply chains are so fragile that they break at a moment's notice.
And Andrew thinks some of these sources of inflation, like tenuous supply chains or growing disparities between company profits and worker pay, could actually be helped by a more robust labor movement.
To have an organized labor force with which you can make reasonable accommodations through a predictable bargaining process, rather than the complete lack of predictability in the current moment. So you have, you know, teachers going off on a wildcat strike, or you have baristas in Starbucks beginning, you know, what potentially could be a you know, wildfire campaign of organizing. And, you know, this could be the tip of the iceberg. We could be back to the 1930s with sit-down strikes and general strikes and all sorts of tumult in the labor market, let alone in politics. And, you know, if instead you tried to create a predictable system of industrial relations with a 21st century labor law for a 21st century labor movement and a 21st century economy, I think we could deal with inflation in a pretty straightforward manner. The countries that have the highest levels of unionization, say the Scandinavian countries, are not poor countries. They're rich countries. They're also highly equitable countries. Workers are treated well, and they're highly productive. So it's kind of a win-win situation for everybody. But that high road capitalism requires two parties. It requires employers to be on one side of the table. It requires workers to be at the other side of the table, quite likely with government, you know, serving as the good faith party intervening between the two.
But as Andrew makes clear, providing workers a voice, whether through unions or new institutions and systems that we maybe haven't even invented yet, it isn't just important for creating a vibrant economy in the coming decades. It's more than just our global competitiveness on the line.
In the United States today, at the lower tier of the labor market, you've had people who are at best running to stay in place and in many cases going backward. One way or the other, something's got to give. You know, you just can't sustain these levels of inequality through this many shocks over that long a period without seeing some sort of upsurge. That upsurge can either be channeled in a productive direction to create some form of high road capitalism, or it can be channeled in an unproductive direction by populists and xenophobes and bigots and people who are ultimately going to take a toll not just on the workers at the lower tier of the labor market, but ultimately on the entire country as society unravels.
Andrew Schrank, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about this.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
This episode of Trending Globally was produced by me, Dan Richards, and Sam McKeever-Holtzman. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. Additional music by the Blue Dot Sessions. We'll put links in the show notes to more of Andrew's research and analysis of the labor movement in the U.S. If you like the show, please make sure to subscribe and leave us a rating and review on whatever listening apps you use. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Trending Globally. Thanks.